Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Public Health Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Madison, also known as the Public Health Pharmacist. This is part of Pharmacy Times' Pharmacy Focus podcast series. I have another incredible guest with me here today, Dr. Abolata, who comes from us all the way from Oakland, California. So, and I say that with a little bit of a funniness because she's very close to me. So I live in Las Vegas, and so I could literally get on a flight and be where she is probably within under an hour. So she's very close and just really excited to talk about the work that she's doing in her community. And fun fact, we met because we were both part of a summit that was conducted at the White House last year. So all things health equity, this particular seminar slash workshop that we did, there was a poster session at the White House, and our symposium really focused on COVID-19 and how specifically her clinic, the Roots Healthcare Center, and some of the work that I did really focused on health equity and getting care to those who are underserved. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and let Dr. Abolata introduce herself, and then we're going to dive into some questions about her unique clinic that's located in Oakland, California.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here. I'm Noha Abolata, and I am a family physician by training, and I'm the founding CEO at Roots Community Health Center. We're headquartered in East Oakland, and we serve Oakland and San Jose, so the greater Bay Area.
Wonderful. So we have two versions of this podcast. So one is audio and one is visual. So we have a YouTube version of this as well. So tell us a little bit about sort of your journey to opening up your own clinic specifically in this area and your connection to the area, you know, as another woman of color, for those of us who are watching versus just listening. I was really inspired by the work that your clinic did when I met you in November last year. And part of it was, realizing that we have, physician colleagues that are really, not just talking the talk, but walking the walk and understanding the need for caring for communities of color. And so would love to just hear sort of like how your journey started, how you came to open the clinic. And obviously we'll talk a little bit about the impact that you guys have made in spite of the fact that you probably don't get as much funding as you probably should.
Thanks for that. And the feeling was really mutual when we met in DC, and just knowing that we have pharmacist colleagues that are doing this really critical public health work, and how folks were really able to mobilize, in the height of the pandemic, but also how we've been doing this work, long before the pandemic as well. I was born and raised in Oakland, and I went to Oakland Public Schools and went on to college and figured out I wanted to go to medical school kind of late in college, when I realized that, I'd always loved science. So I had always kind of gravitated towards science, but I did not really care to be in the lab. I really liked interacting with people. I was a tutor. I'd been a tutor since like high school. And I just loved being able to kind of translate hard things to people wherever they kind of were. And so that kind of, I had an aha moment at some point, like, that's kind of what doctors do, or at least that's what we're supposed to do. So from there, I decided to go to medical school, went to Howard in DC. And then I did my residency training in Pomona, Pomona Valley Hospital Medical Center, one of the UCLA affiliate programs. And you know, I felt that what I was most interested in was like everything. Like I loved, you know, emergency and adult and kids and everything. So I went into family medicine and really felt like that was going to be the best way for me to really engage with what I kind of always knew I wanted to do, you know, which was community health. And so, you know, my cousin reminds me that like in high school, I had talked about a health village or something like that, where it was like, you know, you could go to the doctor, but you could also go get like a healthy smoothie or, you know, something like that. So we don't quite have the village yet, but it's kind of funny to think that like all the way back then I was like, this would be great.
Put that on a t-shirt.
Okay. Exactly. We'll get there. We're getting there, I think. I came back home essentially after my training, with the goal of working within a community health center. So I sort of already knew this is the type of medicine I wanted to do, community medicine. And so I worked in a couple of different federally qualified health centers. So those are sort of, you know, safety net institutions that really provide an amazing and tremendous amount of care to folks who are uninsured or underinsured, and, you know, got into sort of leadership within, you know, within those organizations. And I still kept feeling like, okay, you know, we're not going to be able to get ahead of all these disparities I'm seeing. You know, I'm not just looking at the patients in front of me. I'm kind of still looking at what's going on in the community overall. And I'm seeing, you know, my hometown of Oakland is always lighting up on the map for all the things that you don't want to see. And then particularly the areas of East Oakland and West Oakland at that time, which was like every map, every indicator, everything that I looked at was like, why are, you know, African-American people dying 15 years younger if you live, you know, in East Oakland compared to like up the hill? Why, you know, what is going on with, you know, all of these indicators like diabetes and asthma? Why is it always these same neighborhoods? Like, what is really going on here? And so I just kind of like, it was like more questions than answers as far as I was concerned, because for me in the exam room, I felt good. Don't get me wrong. I'm helping people. I'm making connections with my patients, you know, but also it's like, you never had enough time to really understand how did we get here? Like what, and is this even sustainable if we're just kind of, you know, treating one person after the other, but we don't have time to say, okay, how did we get here? What were the things that led to this, you know, premature heart attack, or, you know, this diabetes at a young age, or how could we have prevented these things? And realizing that it had as much or more to do with people's environment and the community that they lived in than, you know, a number of other different factors. And so this process kind of led me to really, I mean, actually just driving around the areas that I was seeing lighting up on the map. Of course, I knew the areas, but with a different lens now, because now I've come back with my training and I'm trying to understand what's going on. Like, do we not have enough doctors? Do we like, what's going on? Well, of course, the answer was not because we have a shortage of doctors. Now that is a challenge, and in some areas more than others. But, you know, you could put 100 doctors in East Oakland and we weren't going to solve the issues that we were seeing. And so I said, well, no, we have to go find the people that aren't coming into the doctor's office, right? And with, you know, with a lot of, with that.
I said, absolutely. Like that. Yeah. Like when you don't make the environment friendly, warm, and welcoming for people to come to, they're not going to seek medical attention. And then that's exactly how you end up with all these acute issues versus preventing those things from happening, because people delay seeking care until something's really wrong because they don't feel comfortable accessing the traditional healthcare system.
Absolutely, 100%. And, you know, at that time, it was also before the Affordable Care Act, which was an absolute game changer. Of course, again, getting coverage isn't also the same as access. And it's also not the same as access you feel comfortable, you know, taking advantage of. And so, you know, at that time, when we first started, it was like 2008, myself and Nurse Ophelia Long, and the two of us were like this two-person volunteer operation. We were just like driving around East Oakland. We were going to places where we knew people were who were not getting care. So, you know, people who had come out of incarceration, people who were maybe in substance use rehab, but really were not, you know, receiving or accessing primary care, folks who were essentially receiving their care, as you were alluding to, in the emergency department, because they were not accessing care. And so we really just started going and literally doing like house calls, like going and delivering care on site to folks where they were staying and learning, you know, again, coming with more questions than answers, like where, you know, why aren't you able to access care? Why aren't you accessing care? And a lot of things had to do with, at the heart of it, is really not being empowered to do so and not feeling like I might, you know, I might be mistreated. I might be told no, I might not get any help. I might be judged. And so all of these things kind of led to avoiding the whole entire healthcare system, you know, until something so bad that now you're going to the emergency room where, again, you'll be judged, mistreated. You were either, you know, you waited too long. Why didn't you do this? You know, you were told to do this, but you didn't do it. Now you're non-compliant, you know, and so
being medication seeking because now you're in excruciating pain and they think that you're, you know, somehow just there for like pain meds, right? Even though, you know, we know that Black people are, you know, thought that they can tolerate more pain, that their skin is thicker, like all of these horrible, like misnomers that unfortunately, like still perpetuate through medical education. And you still, unfortunately, hear those, you know, those misnomers. As you know, myself, I've been a victim of, you know, being denied care because I'm a woman of color. So I get it. Like, you know, when you go to seek the care, even when you think you're supposed to get the care that you deserve and are, you know, supposed to get, you're not even getting that, even when you chose to only go when you thought it was an absolute emergency.
Exactly. And, you know, those stories stick, they pass down through generations. So when, you know, and so I was fortunate to have trained, as I mentioned, at Howard, which is a sickle cell center. So I trained under some of the most amazing people and really learned about the pain that is incurred. And I also found myself having to later fight for my patients with sickle cell because, you know, they know what pain medication is going to touch that excruciating pain of a crisis. And they're labeled everywhere they go as drug seeking. And it is a horrific thing to be inflicted with that type of pain and then be labeled on top of that and not be able to even get the help you need because of it. And so, you know, it's one example, but like I said, those stories make it around the world, you know, and certainly passed down and folks don't trust because people they love, people in their family have been mistreated. And, you know, people talk about Tuskegee and things like that as if nothing's happened since back then, but we know that that is absolutely not the case. And unfortunately, whether it's explicit or whether it's implicit, there is bias in healthcare. And there are structural issues in healthcare that we're uncovering to this day. You know, we are right now advocating and fighting to get the pulse oximeter devices fixed. And to think that now in 2023,
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, it just came up. Yeah.
I mean, like, we had a Black female physician who basically died in the hospital and told them like repeatedly, like what she needed, when she needed it. And then after the hospital blamed her for her own death, told, you know, the media with the statement that she bullied that. I'm like, how is this possible? Like in 2021, I think is when it happened. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how is this real life? Like,
no, and these are things we've seen. We've seen them, we've experienced them, you know, where advocating for yourself is now you're combative or you're bullying. And we see these labels, the way these labels get applied, I don't think people realize how damaging this is because once something is in your medical chart for the next physician or provider to see, you know, it changes the nature of that. If you say, oh, this person is not compliant, that means, oh, they're not going to listen to what I'm going to say anyway. So I'm not going to really try as hard. I'm not going to explain it as thoroughly and so on. And so, you know, these all of these labels, I think, and it's shameful to see that happened. And she's a physician and she still ended up getting this label. And then come to find out, I mean, as myself and colleagues were kind of you know, here locally and in our county, seeing African-Americans dying at double the rate of everybody else from COVID. Why? You know, we partnered with a local hospital system and we were seeing that after you accounted for underlying conditions, because, you know, everyone wants to say, oh, it's this, oh, it's that, oh, it's this. No, let's look at the data. And once you accounted for socioeconomics, you accounted for underlying conditions, there was still a disparity. And so we were kind of, you know, like on a mission to try to figure out what is going on here. And that is when all of this information around the pulse oximeter came about, because, you know, you'll recall that the pulse ox device that clips on your finger, that was the only objective measurement that we were using to decide, right? Do you go to the hospital? Does the ambulance take you to the hospital? Do you get admitted? Do you get oxygen, or do you get sent home to die? And for that device to systematically overestimate oxygen saturation in people with darker skin tones is criminal. I say criminal because it was known before all of this happened. And now how many people did we lose? You know, we lost so many people. And the, you know, we know that if your reading was, you know, looked fine, right? If it's systematically 3 or 4 points higher, let's say, you're above that threshold. We didn't have enough hospital beds at one point. We didn't have enough oxygen in some places. We had lines out the door of ambulances in some places. So, you know, that was easy. Okay, no, you don't get to come in. You get to go home and die. And this was happening disproportionately. So for something like that, and, you know, once I started to really do the digging, I saw that there was actually academic papers on this topic in 1999, and nobody cared enough to do anything about it. And we know that if roles were reversed, this would not be the case. And so when you talk about, oh, systemic racism in the healthcare, that doesn't exist, or, oh, back with Tuskegee, no, we have contemporary examples. Here's one right here that resulted in real loss of life. And so I think, you know, so keeping all of those things in mind, and it's important that we keep those in mind, we have to take ownership. And, you know, I think we all have to take responsibility, because, you know, when we know things aren't quite right, but it's like, there's so much to do. There's so many sick people to take care of. There's so many prescriptions to fill. And, you know, I think part of our work at Roots, in addition to providing the direct service and really, you know, surfacing some of these issues, is no, now we have to fight, because if we don't advocate around it, it'll be another decade and another pandemic, and we'll have the same problem, and we'll have never addressed or fixed this issue. And so I think we have to take ownership and understand that the work we're doing is actually, not only does it have to be good, it has to be culturally responsive, and it has to be excellent, it has to meet people where they are, it has to overcome like a legacy of absolute distrust. And, you know, it has to really overcome earned distrust, you know, I'll say.
They're like, oh, well, I just don't understand like what this comes from. I'm like, let's think about the historical trauma that has been, you know, perpetuated for decades on, you know, people of color, obviously, in particular Black people. But like, there is so much, like, I can't, it's some, and sometimes when I get asked this question, because I'm sure you get this asked this question too, from your colleagues, they're like, well, I just don't understand, like, what do you mean? Like, you know, like, when I think about all the different examples, right, and not just examples of things that have happened in the past, but in modern times, like you mentioned, right, like we have real world examples from now, not from Tuskegee, from now, where there has been mistreatment, and even just now seeing sort of the thought process around trying to reconcile some of those wrongs, you know, seeing like the judgment with this new settlement with Henrietta Lacks's family. You're seeing now the identification of the enslaved women that were experimented in by Dr. Sims, like all of these things that are trying to get at sort of healing and reconciliation, but not quite making the mark, because you still don't have people who understand that that's just like the tip of the iceberg.
Right. And I think we can do important, meaningful gestures or ways to try to compensate for these things. And that is important. And I think we have to understand that the structure remains, and the business of the structure of healthcare churns on. And so there's a lot of work that would need to be done. When we talk about health equity, right? And you know, get worried that, you know, it just becomes this buzzword that people say without really doing it. But when you're actually utilizing that framework, you're saying we need to take the people who've been the most harmed, the most pushed to the margins, and put them in the center of our work and develop around that. That is not what healthcare is doing. It doesn't matter how much you say equity or what have you. Equity is not a project. It's not an office in the, you know, off to the side in the basement. It has to be central and core to the work that we do. And that's why, you know, and it's not just about, you know, structural issues in healthcare. I mean, you know, I mentioned the maps, right? Those maps, if you go back to 1929, the same areas are red from the redlining map, right? And so this is basically by design, essentially, you have entire neighborhoods and areas where people were systematically locked out of economic opportunity. Bad actors and industry polluters were brought in, allowed in, welcomed in. And then now I'm like, why do we have such high asthma rates? Right. Well, right. It's like how you've built the environment. Mm-hmm.
It's where their homes are located, because they can't purchase anything outside of those areas because they were told that they weren't allowed to, you know, purchase houses in the quote unquote white neighborhoods, you know, and even after it was technically outlawed, it was still being done. The banking system was still doing it. You know, you see it with the undervaluing of homes that are in certain zip codes because, you know, those were traditionally the houses that were part of Black neighborhoods. And so I'm sure you probably saw the story that aired about the family who, you know, they had one estimate of the home, and then they had their friends come in and they put up all pictures of their family, same home, same everything. And the value of the home went up by like 20%. And the only difference was that they had their, you know, themselves, which were a Black family, versus their friends that came in were a white couple. So like, you know, we know it's still happening. It's just, you know, how do we help from a community basis, right? Which is what you're really involved in. And another thing too, that I wanted to just touch on, because this is, you know, a part of public health that maybe doesn't get as much attention, is carceral health and sort of the thought process around recidivism and, you know, people, you know, coming back into society. And, you know, a lot of times why people reoffend is because they don't have access to healthcare or to mental health services, or access to food, transportation, right? Because there's no one there welcoming them when they come out to try to help them to, you know, get back into society, right? So like the initial goal behind, you know, being part of that carceral system is that you've paid your debt to society. And once you leave, you should be able to reintegrate into society, but we don't allow for that. And a lot of the challenges that occur are directly related to healthcare. And you see that with mental health problems, you see it with a lot of our patients that are HIV positive, not having access to meds once they leave the carceral system. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about the work that you guys are doing in this space, but I do think it's really important to mention that carceral health is actually part of public health. And when we think about public health as sort of an umbrella, that is definitely one of the factors and one of the main portions of the system that we really need to provide good healthcare to people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's funny. I was about to go there next, because as we were sort of talking about, you were talking about the home ownership and things like that, and how that has really robbed people of the opportunity to develop generational wealth. And when you look at that same, the redlining map, that's also the same map as the number of arrests. And we know that there has historically, again, been, you know, racial profiling and over policing and inappropriate policing, and sometimes, oftentimes criminalization of behavioral health issues, which disproportionately is towards men of color, especially Black men, where you have a behavioral health issue and instead of getting routed to the assistance that you need, it's looked at through a different lens of being criminal. And then that person is getting incarcerated and repeatedly incarcerated. And Alameda County, and this is not unique to Alameda County, but this is, you know, across the country where our prisons are our largest mental health providers. And so this is, again, a systemic choice, essentially, that we've made around how we are addressing people with behavioral health challenges, but also, you know, just what we are choosing to criminalize and when. I mean, there wasn't that long ago where Black young men were being incarcerated around cannabis. And now you have these young entrepreneurs trying to come into East Oakland, buying up property in order to have their legalized, you know, now where those people's lives were affected and sometimes really destroyed
taken away from them for minimal amounts of something that is now a billion with a B dollar industry. I also live in an area where cannabis is huge. First started off with medical, and then now recreational. And now we have cannabis lounges where people can now come and patronate the strip and also get their, you know, their cannabis du jour, right? Like, and you think about all these people that were criminalized, right? It was sort of a way for policing as well. One of the things that they would say, they smelled some type of cannabis. Like that was a means for search and seizure that was done oftentimes. And now you see this being like such a huge industry. So I think we definitely need to talk about it. We definitely need to, obviously the first step is knowing that there's a problem, right? That's what they say, knowing the problem is the first thing, calling it out, right? You can't fix what you can't name, right? Yes. And so that's a big thing as well. I think having programs like yours in particular, where you are warm, welcoming, very much a fixture of your community. You said you guys have been doing this since 2008. I don't know how long you've had your brick and mortar location, but I do think that like having that sort of beacon of hope and light in your community is just so important. We were chatting right before we hit record, but having sort of a unicorn, right, of this facility, I think is so important. However, I do want to say that although you may be unique because you have decided to focus on what traditionally has not been seen as profitable, I don't think that that means that that can't be replicated. So with that being said, I know you guys have, you know, strong pillars, strong values. What is the number one thing that you would say that if a clinic or another healthcare facility wanted to start doing some of this work, what would be one of the things that you could say that they could do today to just start on that journey to be more community minded and really community centric?
Thank you for that question. That's a great one. I think the first step is definitely a commitment, you know, from the highest level to say, we are going to take responsibility, you know, not only just for disease care and preventive medicine, but actually to broaden our lens to say, what is it that is keeping our patients from experiencing the best health? And in our case, where it was, you know, primarily poverty, being shut out of the workforce, oftentimes because of a record, having been formerly incarcerated, we realized that what we needed was a support structure for people, including those who are coming back from incarceration. So, for example, we have navigators who are basically like community health outreach workers. They have to have been impacted by incarceration themselves. And they have a panel of members that are coming out of jail or prison that they're helping navigate. And this is something that has absolutely improved, you know, patients coming to their medical appointments, getting their prescriptions filled. So this is going to serve your purpose as a clinic and as a primary care provider. But it also means doing things a little bit differently. It's not only about medical personnel. It's also about hiring from the community, people who share life experiences with the people that you're serving. If nobody in your office understands what your community, your patients are going through, it's going to be a lot harder to get them to, you know, do all the things that we're trying to ask them to do. And I think the other part of the commitment and focus that has been critical is to understand, like, in healthcare, we are going to have certain things we're focused on. I want my patients with diabetes to have their, you know, diabetes controlled. And I want, you know, people to get all of their preventative screenings on time. But if people are struggling with, the only thing I care about right now is getting custody back of my child, or I'm living in a car right now, I need to get a roof over my head before I'm going to go, you know, get a mammogram, you know. And so I think, you know, it sounds like a no-brainer, but I think what healthcare has done is said, oh, they didn't get the mammogram, you know, not my problem. That's non-compliance. That's them not following through. And I get that. We're busy. You have a lot of people to take care of. But at the end of the day, the goal is to improve health outcomes. And that means that we're going to have to do more than just passively wait there for people who have needs to come in and get what they need. And then I think the last thing would be, you know, for us, we really take a neighborhood approach. We think about the neighborhood that we put ourselves in, obviously, and what the needs are. And we're constantly responsive to those needs. So in other words, we're not just saying whoever walks in the door, we're saying who needs us most and how can we go get them? How can we encourage them to come in? Because that way, and we see, you know, we see it in the data, we are keeping people from going back to jail. We are keeping people from going back to psychiatric emergency or to the emergency department. Why? Because they have a place in the community that they trust that they can come to get what they need, you know, whether that is food or whether that is just a kind word from someone who looks like them or is from their community, or whether it is a doctor's appointment or a mental health appointment, or maybe it's job training. We ended up developing two social enterprises where we train people who've been marginalized from the workforce, because if the biggest barrier to good health in our community is poverty, what are we doing about that? How are we helping people to mobilize? And so I know that that can sound like a lot, especially in traditional healthcare delivery. But I would say, starting small, what is the biggest challenge that you are facing? What is the biggest challenge that your patients are facing that is keeping them from good health? And what is maybe one person that you could hire from the community and support so that they could support them? And with the new, you know, community health worker benefits that are out there now, with the restructuring, especially in California around CalAIM and covering things that aren't traditionally thought of as healthcare, those are things that could be tapped into. But I think it really does start with that commitment and that willingness to truly be part of the community that you're serving.
Yeah, I think those are all fantastic suggestions. I know that there's, you know, probably people are like, man, that's so many things. That's so that's a lot of different ways that I can help my community. But I do know that, you know, the funding side is always, you know, sort of the pink elephant in the middle of the room when we're talking about, you know, why aren't we doing these things? And I think a lot of times funding or being reimbursed for services, right? When you're talking about sort of the restructuring around community health workers and then being compensated for their services, I think is super important. So in addition to hiring people from the community, maybe even thinking about investing in like grant writers or people who understand, you know, sort of the, you know, what I would consider unique payment models, right? So that you can think about ways that you can get people trained for a job or access to, you know, having, you know, a nice outfit so that they can go for a new interview for a job, you know, like that kind of stuff we don't think about a lot of times. Or, you know, I had a patient one time when I was still doing work with one of our community hospitals where, you know, they kept coming in with diabetic foot when it came to find out, like, he just didn't have a good pair of shoes. And like, obviously the diabetes was impacting his ability to feel, but part of the reason why he kept having these infections is because he kept getting cuts because he didn't have a proper pair of shoes. Like, can you imagine, like, you leave the hospital with no meds, like, here's just a nice pair of shoes, like a pair of shoes that will keep your, you know, keep you clean, safe, warm, right? Like, just the little things. Like, I just wonder, how do we get here as a society to where we, you know, we can't think about caring for those who have the least, right? Like, absolutely. That's such a measure of a society. And I just think we are failing. Like, and it just, and I'm so thankful for programs like yours, because I know that you're making an impact. You know, data talks. So you've mentioned that multiple times. So I'm curious, you know, do you have someone that is actively, you know, getting some of this information so that you can publish it, so that you can get more resources, so that you can get more funding?
Yeah, I mean, well, now we're a team, we're a big team. We're over 200 full-time employees now. We've got multiple sites throughout Oakland and San Jose. So we've grown a lot. So we do have a team. We finally have our first grant writer, because with just a few months, just, you know, like 6 months ago, because up until then it was like each of the program directors would kind of write their own grants, myself included. I've written many. But I would say, you know, there's not a one size fits all in the way that we have approached it, which, you know, people in healthcare think sounds completely opposite of what, you know, we've learned. The way we've approached it is, what does our community need? That's the first question. Then who's going to pay for it, right? And so that may sound, you know, overly simplistic or super risky or something like that, but it really isn't, because, you know, in most cases, if these are, especially if we're talking about working in the safety net, you know, there are these needs, but you may have to cross sectors a little bit. For instance, we work with, you know, the county social services department, you know, because we do so much benefits enrollment. So we partner with them. Sometimes we have contracts with them. So depending on what type of, you know, need there is, there often is a funder, a pot of money, a reimbursement mechanism, and things can start to get complicated, you know. So I will say that we have a fairly sophisticated, you know, revenue pie, if you will. But I think, you know, oftentimes, you know, even, you know, like I said, if we decide, okay, violence is what's really plaguing our community, and this is why, you know, our young people are so frightened, and why, you know, and we want to be able to help address these things, can we, you know, hire someone within our office who is trained, you know, in violence prevention? Or, you know, so, I mean, I think there's a ton of different examples where this is something that's currently being actually reimbursed through Medi-Cal. So I think keeping up on these things, because a lot of people don't know, like, community health workers, we have some reimbursements now for community health workers. It's not very much, but, you know, those of us who serve the Medi-Cal population, we know how to stretch resources. And a lot of these, you know, offices do know how to stretch resources, but it's kind of like staying on top of how to be able to do things. Or you may decide, you know, we should really become a nonprofit, you know, so that we can write grants and we can, you know, get donations, for example. If you, certain communities, that will work perfectly, especially if you have an affluent community that wants to partner with you to help solve these problems, you can do things. And I don't think you have to start huge. I think sometimes just starting with a health fair, you know, where people get to know who you are and you can test for things and you can, you know, and you can bring in new patients, but also be an asset in the community. So I think starting from wherever is comfortable, but really asking the question, like, what is needed and then who's going to pay for it? It's actually easier than it might sound.
Well, I really appreciate that pep talk. I hope everyone is like, yes, we can do this. It may not look pretty, but we're going to make it work, right? Like, sometimes you got to, you know, take from a little bit over here and a little bit over here. And
partner. I forgot to say partner. I mean, it may be, you may be your physician and you can assist in a church health ministry or, you know, some other things like that. So I think you can start with I think volunteerism is important, but I think meaningful partnership is even more critical. And those can build into things that you can really embed within your community. So it's something that people can count on.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned the faith-based organizations, especially when you see communities of color, during the pandemic, they were, salvation and refuge, no pun intended. And I do think that when we started going and partnering with those faith-based organizations, we saw, better acceptance of some of the interventions that we were trying to do to mitigate issues around COVID. And really, obviously, we say this all the time, but meeting people where they are. Where are people going? Where are people congregating, right? Is it the community center? Is it at the church? Is it, the park? Like, where are they going, right? Kind of like what you guys did in the beginning when you were just driving around, just figuring out what people were up to and why weren't they going to the doctor. And, you're just like me, like you look people up and down and you're like, okay, obviously that swelling isn't supposed to be there. Obviously it's been a while since you've gone to the dentist. Let's talk about how that poor dentition is probably impacting your overall health and wellness. Oh, you've always had partial teeth. Tell me why that is. Like, tell me, like, how can we help you? Like, why don't you like going to the dentist? I can't tell you how many times I've talked to people who've said, I'm just frightened and that's where I don't want to go. And it's like caused so many health problems because it's like, if you don't have proper dentition or if you have dental caries or dental infections, like it can cause so many problems with, the rest of your body. And, obviously I'm a pharmacist by training, but, I spent a decade in a public health department and I literally got asked to do everything you could possibly think of, including fluoride varnish on teeth. So like lead prevention, lead screenings, like all of these things, which traditionally are harder hit and more impacted in Black and Brown communities. Right. And so I really just think that, as a takeaway, even if you're not living in a minority community, you have people that are in need. And how are you going to help those people in need? Whether that's partnering with a faith-based organization, whether that's partnering with a CBO, you can do the work and you can make an impact. And it just takes very little of your time. And I do think that, your model and the fact that you guys have been able to grow so quickly is a testament to leading with community, right? Like you led with the community. Your first question is always, how can I improve someone's health, right? And then you kind of work backwards, like, okay, what can I do? How can I make this intervention? And then you think about how am I going to pay for it, right? Versus the reverse, which is traditionally how our healthcare system works, which is pay for service, fee for service versus paying for outcomes. And I love that you really are focused about the outcomes and the overall health and wellness of your community.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Our healthcare system has gotten so complicated. You were speaking about the mouth, it's like we've separated the mouth from the brain, from the body, and just made it so overly convoluted and complicated. And so I do think it helps for all of us to kind of do that gut check, kind of soul search, take a step back. Why am I in healthcare? And if it's to improve the overall outcomes, like how are we going to get there? And that's going to be a different answer depending on who you're serving and where you are. But being part of that solution of how we're going to get there, I think is going to be so important because, medicine is really, at kind of, I think we've seen a lot in the last few years to understand how not thinking in this way has led us to a point where, we performed very poorly for a country of our wealth in this pandemic because we really didn't have, I think, not only the public health infrastructure, but just the basics, the basic education. We've leaned very heavily on our technology, on our medications. And as we saw, they can be overwhelmed, like they can be overrun. And they can get it wrong, like we saw with the pulse oximeter as well. And so I think taking a step back from all of that and just saying, how do we as healthcare take responsibility for the overall health and well-being? And then what do we need to get there? And it is, you know, besides for being effective, it is very fulfilling. Like, we have a number of physicians at Roots and, you know, who basically feel like, I can be a doctor and do what I was trained to do, but I also know that this navigator is going to help them get the food. The navigator is going to help them make sure they have a roof over their head. I'm not just sending them back out into the street with a pamphlet and saying, good luck with calling these phone numbers. You know, I'm actually able to help them achieve their own goals and achieve stability. And there's no better fulfillment, like, as a physician, that I could ask for. Even if the intervention has nothing to do with a prescription, you know, it's a referral to a workforce, you know, our workforce development, a social enterprise. And now I can see them looking happy, feeling fulfilled, transforming their life. I mean, it really is kind of what we went into it for. And it's good to not lose sight of that.
Yeah. Well, I tend to ask, I know I'm going to ask you a question, and I didn't tell you this in advance, so hopefully you won't get too upset with me. I usually ask my guests this question. If you could tell your younger self anything, what would it be and why?
Oh, that's a good one. You know, I've never been asked this question before. I guess for me, and maybe, you know, maybe this is just because, you know, I think staying focused and staying, just stay true to yourself, because I think I did a pretty good job of staying focused, and I think I did a pretty good job of staying true to myself, but there's moments along the way where, you know, folks are like, why is she doing that? Why does, you know, why would a clinic have a soap factory? Like, that's crazy to ask what's needed and pay for it later. Like, that's never going to work. And I think those things, they didn't take me off track, but at the same time, you know, it does sometimes make you be like, okay, is this going to work? And, you know, so just stay the course. I think it's probably just stay the course, which is what I'm telling my current self now too.
Well, and really just staying true to yourself and true to your values, right? Yeah. Like, and not letting the noise really, you know, impact how you choose to, you know, live your life and how you choose to impact your community. You know, I would say the only other thing that I would add is that, like, how incredible you are. Like,
oh, and thank you.
Like, to tell your younger self, you're amazing.
Absolutely. You're amazing,
and you are gonna make meaningful change.
Thank you for that. That's a really good one. I appreciate that. That's something we don't tell ourselves often enough. So I will take that to heart and right back at you.
All right. Well, this has been such a great conversation. Unfortunately, we have to end because Dr. Abuleta has to go see her patients. Continue to, you know, make waves in the Oakland community, and continue to get people housing and fed and job security and all of the things. So with that, I will end with saying, you know, you never know who needs to hear what you have to say. So speak up and speak often. And you never know the impact that you'll make. So even if it's just a small change, even if it's just, you know, showing up somewhere where you're unexpected, to stay the course, and to, you know, trust your gut and to really lean into, you know, those instances that, you know, you have that instinct to, you know, do something without knowing what the benefit's going to be on the back end. Because sometimes just showing up is the gift, right? And that's okay. So this has been another episode of Public Health Matters. And I hope that for those of you who are listening or who are watching, continue to follow me on this journey as I interview incredible pillars in our healthcare system. I love that I'm able to get incredible guests to come and talk about their journey, how they're making an impact, and really talking about why public health is something that we should be focusing on as a whole and as a society. And I do think that this is going to help us to be happier and healthier. And with that, I am your host, Dr. Christina Madison. And remember, public health matters.